This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, September 27th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF is provided by the Cherokee Art Market, Oklahoma's Native American art show. It takes place October 8th and 9th inside the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tulsa. More information is available at CherokeeArtMarket.com.
This summer was fairly busy in state politics for a non-election year. The governor's choice to lead the Department of Higher Education was met with criticism and then withdrew his name from consideration. The head of the Arkansas Lottery announced his resignation, and government officials learned the state has overpaid unemployment benefits. Two of this state's most read political bloggers, Jason Tolbert, who leans right, and Michael Cook, who leans left, recently sat down in the studio of our content partner Talk Business to discuss the state of politics in Arkansas and beyond. Jason Tolbert from the Tolbert Report began the discussion by asking Michael Cook about Democratic office holders' responsibilities for recent issues.
Well, Michael, we've seen the news the last couple of weeks. There's been some rather high-profile missteps among some of the directors of some of the state agencies. Artie Williams over at the Department of Workforce Services. Looks like there's maybe $161 million possibly in improper payments that were made. Of course, Director Ernie Passway over at the state lottery has had all sorts of missteps that we've seen the last few months. What responsibility do you feel like Democrats, the party in control, has to take for a lot of those missteps? Any, or how much do they take?
Well, I don't think it's really a partisan issue. You know, first of all, R.T. Williams, the head of the Department of Workforce Services, was first appointed by Governor Mike Huckabee in 2004. So, you know, if anybody, if it comes down to a partisan blame game, we should be blaming Republicans. But I don't think it's a blame game. You know, there was the first report that the unemployment division may have given out $161,000 in benefits, $161 million in overpayments. And now it appears that maybe it's $11 million is what the latest I've heard. Now, that's still an $11 million problem, don't get me wrong. I'm not downplaying and a mistake is a mistake. But apparently it's a big difference between $11 million and $161 million. That is a misstep. But let's see what comes out. And unfortunately, it looks like Arkansas, along with other states, has had problems with overpayment of unemployment benefits. So we're not alone in this mishap. But I'm still keeping my mind open in terms of what comes out. In terms of Ernie Passalag, he was hired by a board, independent board from the Democratic Party structure. Governor Beebe did not appoint him, had no say who was hired. And while he had a lot of missteps, he also had a lot of successes. That's unfortunately one thing that will not be remembered for quite a while, is that when the lottery was first proposed, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whatever it was, the Republicans were saying, oh, this thing is not going to raise more than $55 million. And Democrats or people supporting it said, no, it's going to raise $100 million. Turns out it has. So the success of the lottery is that it's funded about 60,000 scholarships for kids who go to college who may not have had that opportunity now. So it has been a successful program, but they've had some problems in terms of this growing agency that had to start quickly, and they've had some missteps. I think Ernie Passalag was probably the right person to get it started, but probably not the right person to keep it going. And so hopefully the commission will find somebody who's qualified, who has some lottery experience, to keep the lottery generating scholarships for Arkansas kids.
You know, I think the thing I hear from a lot of people on this is there adequate oversight in place for these things? I don't know that necessarily people blame whoever appointed these guys, or whether it's Mike Beebe or Mike Huckabee's fault for appointing these people. Mm-hmm. But are there the right controls in place? Is there the oversight in place? Is there the audit function in place to catch these things? And I don't know that the legislature has to take a step back and look. Do we have enough review and oversight procedures to look at some of these things that are going on? I mean, $161 million, that's a lot of money. That's very material for our overall budget, especially as tight as our budget is right now. Mm-hmm. They've identified $11 million, but that's just what they've identified. I don't know that they're necessarily comfortable with the other $990 million that's out there. Mm-hmm. Are all of those payments correct? I don't mm-hmm. know. But I think there definitely needs to be more oversight in place of those type of things.
You know, I was watching the Republican presidential debates. They had three recently. And in each debate, there was reactions from the crowd that sort of shocked me. You know, in the first debate, there was a question asked of Ron Paul, is that, frankly, if we should let somebody who's a 30-year-old person with no insurance, should we let him die? And the audience reaction was somebody, a couple of people like, yes, let him die, or words to that effect. But basically, you got the impression of people in the audience were like, whatever, too bad he's going to die. You know, the second debate, Governor Rick Perry talked about he's executed almost 300 people during his time as governor. People cheered, which to me, just sort of striking in that no matter what you think about the death penalty, somebody who's committed a crime obviously needs to be held accountable, but do you cheer anybody's death was still kind of disconcerting to me. In the last debate, which happened last night, there was a soldier who recorded something who was actually in Iraq, who asked a question of the presidential candidates, and he got booed by the audience. And the reason he was booed because this soldier who's over there in Iraq fighting for our country just happens to be gay, but was booed by a Republican audience. And the presidential candidates, nobody said anything. Like, look, this guy's fighting for us. Let's not boo the gentleman. But what I'm driving at is, what has happened to compassionate conservatism among the Republican Party? It just seems like they've lost their heart and become followers of Ayn Rand and, you know, who cares about middle class working people, every man for himself. What's happened to the George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism?
Well, I think, first of all, starting out on the debate last night, it seems like the reports I've heard of that was maybe three or four people that actually made those boos. It wasn't the vast majority of the crowd. It was a small minority of people that happened to be sitting in the crowd. I think sometimes those numbers, those things tend to get overstated. People focus on those things. You know, hey, I'm a blogger. When I go looking for stories, I try to find the most sensational part of the story. And so I think those reports have been sensationalized some in the media. I don't think they represent the vast majority of the Republican Party. But just to try to maybe say what those people were thinking, I disagree with that response, but trying to read into their thoughts, I think there's been some people that have the mindset that they just want to kind of rebel against the politically correct thing, the thing everybody expects them to do. I think you saw that maybe especially on the death penalty, where they were maybe trying to show a little bit of rebellion to what the normal response would be. I don't think it was the proper response. I disagree with the response, but that would be my guess as to what that mindset was. Now, as far as compassionate conservatism goes, I think that's alive and well in the Republican Party. I think that's a term, though, that Republicans may be shying away from because that was used a lot during George Bush's administration. Sometimes it was used as a justification for growing the size of government, for advancing different social programs. And so that term itself, I think, has become a term that's not used as much anymore. But conservatism itself, in my opinion, is one of the most compassionate views we can have. Of course, the left and the right have different views of how we go about helping people, but in my opinion, the conservative philosophy is the old saying of it's better to teach a man to fish than to give him fish. And so it's better to go out and create jobs, create the environment where people can work and get back to working again and provide for their family. That's much more compassionate than it is just to simply give someone a government handout and give someone a government program. So in my opinion, compassionate conservatism is alive and well. I think, though, that there is a little bit too much attention put on some of those people that maybe happen to be the loudest and the most vocal in the audience instead of what really the philosophy is.
Well, of course, three or four people in an audience is not, a party make. However, not one of those presidential candidates up on that stage said, hey, guys, no, we shouldn't be clapping about, executing people. No, guys, we shouldn't be booing an American soldier no matter what his beliefs are. He's out there in Iraq right now on the front lines. But none of those candidates had the guts to disagree with those people, those naysayers in the audience would be the first thing I would note. Second of all, those are just the recent examples that have been on my mind. But other things like, Republican Eric Cantor in the House, in the Congress. We've had these, massive disasters in Joplin and these hurricane disasters. And basically his line as one of the leaders in the Republican Party over there is like, well, we can only give funding to help these damaged areas if we cut the budget somewhere else. Basically what he's saying is, look, I know our neighbor's house is on fire, but we need to figure out if we could afford to let them borrow our garden hose first before we can put out the fire. I mean, that's not very compassionate. Not very, wanting to take care of folks in need, especially people who've been wrecked by a hurricane and things that nothing they had no control over. It seems like the Republican Party on the national level has kind of turned the phrase, using instead of saying, or actually now saying, to those who much has been given, nothing is required. And it seems like to be the strain now among the Republican Party on the national level that we don't care about the middle class. You know, we don't care if people don't have health insurance. It's on them. Every man for himself. Follow Ayn Rand's books, and you know exactly what I'm driving at. And that's worrisome. I mean, to George Bush's credit, you know, I obviously had disagreements with him, but he did have a sense of that we're all in this together, that we all need, we all rise or fall together. But it seems now the Republican Party has gone away from that, and now it's every man for himself, which is disconcerting as a country.
Well, I think we're having a real debate about the role of government at this time. It's almost been a forced debate. I think, quite frankly, for the last 10 years, both the left and the right have sort of gotten their way as far as compromises have gone, in the sense that those on the left that have pushed for more programs, for more growing the size of government, have gotten their way. Government has grown quite a bit in the last decade. At the same time, those on the right have gotten their way in the sense that we've cut taxes. And so we've done both of those things at the same time. Almost all the compromises you see is where the deficit has just really grown. We've kicked the can far enough down the road where we can't really do that anymore. And so we've really pushed the debate now to discuss what do we do? What role does government play in our lives? And I think you're seeing a very pointed ideological debate over whether to raise taxes. Barack Obama has opposed $1.5 trillion in tax increases during one of the worst economies we've had in years, which conservatives would tell you that would kill the economy if we were to raise those kind of taxes. And Republicans, on the other hand, are wanting to drastically cut the size of government. That's painful. That's hard to do. Cutting programs is not something that's enjoyable. It's not something that's easy. And so you're going to see some pains as we go through that. But it's been interesting to watch just a real ideological debate now take place. And I think they've come to the point where they no longer can do the kind of compromises they've been doing, where everybody gets their way. Somebody's not going to get their way now. And so that debate has definitely heated up.
You can hear more from the conversation between bloggers Jason Tolbert and Michael Cook at OzarksAtLarge.com. That conversation was recorded in the studio of our content partner, TalkBusiness.net.
And support for content from TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com, and Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information at BankOzarks.com, and Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon communication store or online at VZW.com/small business. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Christina, spent part of last weekend, you were on a sidewalk looking at the stars?
I was. On the corner of West and Dixon.
And this is a part of an outreach project by somebody who loves astronomy.
Yes. His name is Scott Roberts, and he works for a company called Explore Scientific. And his passion is just sharing astronomy with people, with the public.
Let's hear how.
How many of you already have a telescope? Okay. Well, you guys now all raise your hands because you now have a telescope.
That's Scott Roberts. He is president of Explore Scientific, a telescope manufacturer in Springdale. He is donating a telescope to the University of Arkansas Student Astronomical Society.
I know that you guys are dedicated and inspired and passionate about what you're doing, and you're going to change people's lives by doing astronomy outreach. So I encourage you to keep it up all your life, and maybe this little telescope can help just a little bit. So I thank you very much.
AJ Sawal, president and founder of the Student Astronomical Society, or the SAS, says this gift is very meaningful to the young group, as telescopes of this caliber are very expensive. She says that most of these members wouldn't be able to afford one for another 10 years. One of the main goals of SAS is performing community outreach, and this telescope will allow them to take it to another level.
We want people to look through a telescope. We want them to go, whoa, not, 2.0. And this telescope is going to do just that. It's going to really make the outreach that we do mean so much more.
AJ has been hooked on astronomy since she was 7, and she saw the Milky Way for the first time. Her father then taught her about the universe. As a freshman, AJ couldn't believe that there wasn't an astronomy club at the U of A. She, along with another student stargazer, formed SAS. AJ is a senior now, and the club has grown since its founding, with many new faces seen at the telescope's dedication. Kim Zoldak is SAS's outreach coordinator and one of 9 NASA Space Science student ambassadors.
What we do is we do educational outreach. For example, star parties. I did monthly star parties last year. I visited local middle schools, high schools, any kind of conference focusing on women, women in sciences, the STEM field, because I am a woman in science.
After the ceremony on the old main lawn, the group performed some community outreach in the form of sidewalk stargazing. The idea is centuries old, but is new to the streets of Northwest Arkansas. Scott Roberts with Explore Scientific has only been in the area for 1 year. On this particular night, Scott and the SAS group are on Dixon Street in Fayetteville.
What we're doing out here is we are doing astronomy outreach. Okay, where my passion is public outreach and astronomy, and so this is the reason why I do sidewalk astronomy, because I love to show people Saturn, Jupiter, and the moon for the first time.
For Scott and the members of the Student Astronomical Society, talking with people and showing them the universe gives them a rush that is somewhat selfish.
You see people looking and really getting a lot of gratification, a lot of, I can't just say it's recreation, it's not just enjoyment, but it's sort of this sort of profound change that happens when they look and they see something that they know is real and it's live.
Having performed astronomical outreach for 25 years, seeing the awe and wonder on the faces of the oldest and the youngest members of the community is what stands out most for Scott.
On one occasion, this lady had wanted to see Saturn her whole life, you know, she was like 85 years old, and she looks at it and she just bursts out in tears, you know.
On this Friday evening, the group is sidewalk stargazing on the busy corner in front of the Walton Arts Center. They estimate that over 200 people have stopped to look through one of 3 telescopes in the hopes of spying Jupiter.
So that's Jupiter, and the big one is Jupiter. If you look closely, you can see the brown and white stripes.
On another occasion, a few weeks prior, Scott had the opportunity of showing a woman the moon. She was so intrigued that she has stopped by again. The excitement she is exhibiting is not easily hidden.
I saw Jupiter for the first time.
Yeah.
And four moons. Oh, God, that's beautiful.
So if it is a Friday or Saturday night and you're walking down Dixon Street and somebody you don't know offers to let you look in a telescope, go ahead and do it.
Yes.
You don't know what you might see.
No, you have no idea what you might see.
Brand new experience. Have you ever square danced?
I have not.
Nor have I. But last night in the Furman Garner studio, we talked with 3 people who made me want to square dance.
Their music really, it was fun.
It was. It's Fork and Knife, and it's Matt, it's Pete, it's Gretchen. And we had banjo, guitar, and fiddle of course.
Fiddle.
How could I forget the fiddle? Pete and the fiddle. And we're going to hear from them as they play in the Furman Garner studio. That's coming up later.
Yes.
This is Ozarks at Large. Sunday, October 2nd, the 7th Annual Mental Health Vigil, coordinated by Mental Health America in Northwest Arkansas, will be held at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. During the hour-long period, 10 candles will be lit, each representing a different mental health group. John King is a longtime board member of Mental Health America in Northwest Arkansas and joins me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Thank you, Kyle.
10 candles, each one representing a different group?
Right. You've got the right number. Some years ago, the board had a little session and thought, what are our constituents? And we sometimes think about people with mental illness or institutions, but it comes up that there's about 10 important groups, and we wanted to recognize each one of them.
Groups that include military veterans, correct?
Military veterans, and we've been very lucky through the years of having a number of people either as active military or retired veterans. We've had people whose families also have received care through the military system. And, of course, that's become one of the really hot-button issues of modern times with the high rate of suicide coming back from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
That's one of the groups represented by the Kennels. Right. What are some others?
Well, we have substance recovery. And so one of the big areas of addictions and substance abuse, and we always have somebody coming in this year, it'll be a noteworthy person. Judge Marianne Gunn will be lighting that candle. And we ask each person when they light these candles to give a little one-minute, two-minute spiel on why they're lighting the candle this year. We have one for children and adolescents. And once again, one of the real senior and seasoned agencies in town, YouthBridge. And so Paul Hickerson is coming from YouthBridge to talk about but problems among children and adolescents. One of my favorite former colleagues at the university is going to do a family member candle. And this always gets very, very personal. We are always cautious in asking people to light that candle because sometimes it's a matter of outing your family, mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I interesting you bring that up because we know that one propelling idea behind a vigil of any kind is remembrance and a time to be personal. Mental illness, unfortunately, still has a stigma with many people.
That's right.
So if you are there with people who are willing to talk about it, it serves as an event of advocacy as well.
That's right. In fact, you hit on the number one goal for the vigil is to help reduce stigma. Mm-hmm. The more we can do publicly, and in fact, for Mental Health Northwest Arkansas, that has become our major goal ever since we spun off Ozark Guidance Center in the 1960s. This organization helped start Ozark Guidance Center. And after that was successful, we had to kind of look at ourselves and say, okay, what do we do? And it's been community education, advocacy, support, a lot of goals that are not direct service goals. Every once in a while, whoever is president of the organization comes to a board meeting and says, I got four calls this week, you know, looking for service.
Right,
And we do education training more than that. We're recognizing in one of the candles seniors, people over 65. And Sarah Kane Bartlett, who's had a long, long career as a social worker among the elderly of Northwest Arkansas. She worked with the Schmieding Center with Faith in Action. She's now in her own practice helping broker services for elderly people and paying attention to how easy it is for us to ignore our elderly friends and relatives and just write it off as, well, they're getting old.
Mm-hmm.
And so she will be one of our candle lighters. But the best candle of all is the candle of hope. And that's the one we light last. Because all our goals, all our actions, all our activities are with the hope that we can reduce mental illness. We can prevent it. We can find better ways of treatment. And so on our limited budget, we're always trying to find new ways to do it. And so over the last 7 years, this vigil has been a very, very important issue. The 10 candles kind of parallel another ritual that we've had with Northwest Mental Health is a ringing of the mental health bell. And we ring it there. We ring it at our annual banquet. And it's an old farm bell, right? To tell the truth. It's an old farm bell. But there in Arlington, Virginia, there is a bell that looks like the Liberty Bell because it was made to look like the Liberty Bell. But it was cast from chains and shackles from asylums, from hospitals for the mentally ill, where they were chained to the wall. And they took tons of those, melted them down, and cast this bell that is the mental health bell. And it's often been the logo for Mental Health America, to free people And as you said, to reduce the stigma.
You've been involved with the Vigil for 7 years, with mental health in Northwest Arkansas for much longer, social work as a faculty member at the University of Arkansas. Have you seen attitudes change during your career?
Somewhat. And I say somewhat.
But just somewhat.
I think it's somewhat. It's still not, I mean, the stigma's still there. That, you know, and things have changed where I was thinking of the example of politicians, because we're going into a political season. And it used to be that if a politician admitted, I've gone to counseling, I've been in therapy, I've taken antidepressants or something, that was the kiss of death. When I first came here, there were a couple psychiatrists and one psychologist, maybe two, and a couple social workers. And now we have hundreds of social workers. We have dozens of psychiatrists. We have dozens of psychologists. We have professional counselors.
Agencies that can connect you.
All kinds of good. I mean, Ozark Guidance Center has nearly 500 staff now. Mm. Plus, we've got Springwoods and Vista as other psychiatric facilities. We have the new UAMS psychiatric facility at Northwest Medical Center. It is such a blessing. And, of course, population's grown in the meantime. Mm-hmm. And so the demand is still there. And sometimes we never feel like we have quite enough. One of the areas, and we've had people on our candle lighting from the police department, because for a while there, we had no nonprofit inpatient psychiatric beds in Northwest Arkansas. We went for quite a while. And people were showing up in jail because there was no place for them. They couldn't afford private care. The hospitals couldn't take care of them. They ended up sometimes in jail.
Yeah, and there's something about a candlelight vigil where you're there together, but everyone there has their own personal story or something that's
right.
going on.
And after a couple of the vigils, we've had people come up to the panelists, to board members, and say, "I'm thank you for this because," and we get a story. We get another story. So far, nobody's come up and said, "Boy, this was the most rotten thing I've ever." No.
Yeah, that is.
That's never happened.
The vigil itself is Sunday, October 2nd?
6:30 to 7:30. And so we don't have to worry about rain, snow, or anything else. It's a very comfortable place. And no, you don't have to pre-register. You just have to show up. And we usually have a little lighting at the end with those little chemical sticks where everybody lights up a light. So if they want to, they can do that too.
John King, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kyle.
The Candlelight Vigil for Mental Health for America is scheduled for Sunday evening beginning at 6:30 at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville.
Two Arkansas school districts challenged the state's Department of Education School Foundation funding formula in Pulaski County Circuit Court and won round one. Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The problem arose last November when Eureka Springs School District, along with three others, were told by the Arkansas Department of Education they had to return excess millage revenue collected in each district, almost $2.6 million, due to a miscalculation by the Arkansas State Department of Education. The department discovered the discrepancy June 2010. Spokesperson Seth Blumley.
It's one of those unanticipated things that comes up sometimes that you know, no one really thought that there would be an instance where a district would get so much money from the 25 mils of property tax, which is required in every district by Amendment 74. No one thought that district would be able to collect enough from that tax that they would even get more than what the state requires on a per-student basis for an adequate education. It was assumed, and it was through all the calculations we did setting up the funding formula back in 2004 that the state would have to supplement the 25 mils, the property tax, with general revenue, which comes from mostly income tax and sales tax. But in a handful of districts, it's turned out, well, that's just not the case, that they don't, not only do they not need any supplement from general revenue, they get more than they need.
The three other districts are Armorell in Mississippi County, Westside in Cleburne County, and Fountain Lake District located in Hot Springs, Garland County. All tend to be more prosperous districts with fewer students, hence the overage. By law, the state has to provide a foundation of $6,023 per student funding for a Supreme Court-required adequate education collected via the minimum 25 mills in property tax revenue under Arkansas Constitutional Amendment 74. The rest of Arkansas's 245 districts take in less. But the four districts which ended up with extra revenue were ordered last winter by the Arkansas Department of Education, with support from Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, to return the money this past summer to help out the other districts. Armorell and Westside districts have complied, but Eureka Springs Superintendent Wayne Carr with Foundation Lake District Superintendent Darren Beckwith filed a joint suit last May in Pulaski County against the Arkansas Department of Education and State Treasurer, requesting injunctive relief from having to return the money. Nearly $1,400,000 from Fountain Lake and almost $825,000 from Eureka Springs. Last Tuesday, Pulaski County Circuit Court Judge Tim Fox ruled in their favor. According to Arkansas code, each county treasurer shall remit any net revenue, but there is no law saying the money must be redistributed to other schools. Legislation to amend the Arkansas code to allow districts to keep excess money failed to pass out of committee last winter. So with Pulaski County Circuit Judge Tim Fox ruling that Arkansas Department of Education can't keep the excess school millage, what's next? Seth Blumley, Arkansas Department of Education spokesperson.
That's something we're still looking at. We've been consulting with the governor's office and with the attorney general's office on this, and we'll be looking at it more. The ruling kind of made both sides happy, but then it made both sides not happy. It kind of split the difference a little bit. Found that the money in question was indeed state money, which is something we had contended all along. But it also said that in order for us to ask the districts to pay it back to us, we had to have a specific law requiring that. And there is no such specific law. So that's good for the districts. And so we're just going to kind of be evaluating it.
The issue has drawn a great deal of attention to the state's 2004 hotly contested funding formula for equitable and adequate public education, a debate most had thought was long over. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Support for KUAF comes from NWA Media, the publishing source for the region's daily news, including the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, Northwest Arkansas Edition, the Benton County Daily Record, the Rogers and Springdale Morning News, and the Northwest Arkansas Times. NWAonline.com for more information or to sign up for area news alerts.
This is Ozarks at Large. Martha Graham revolutionized dance. She founded the dance company that bears her name in 1926. Critics have placed her importance on dance in the 20th century as equal to that of Stravinsky's on music or Frank Lloyd Wright on architecture. Though she died in 1991, the Martha Graham Dance Company continues to be an innovative company, one of the leaders worldwide. And next week, for the first time in 10 years, that company returns to Arkansas. The Thursday, October 6th performance is at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Janet Alber, the artistic director for the company, will be at the performance.
I think it's something that all types of audiences, I was going to say all sizes and shapes, but young and old and new to dance and sophisticated audience members will appreciate. I think it has to do with the sort of new appreciation America has in general for its past, its cultural past. You know, we sort of have a new perspective on the 20th century and all we achieved as a country, sort of taking our place as a world power and finding our own forms of self-expression, from the greats of American jazz to Gershwin and Copland and Hemingway and O'Keefe and O'Neill, Frank Lloyd Wright. You know, we were really searching for our own national voice. And Martha Graham did that for American movement. Audiences have a new appreciation for that.
I believe the first part of the performance is sort of a guided tour of Martha Graham's career and of her influence and of her work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we like to show the audience theatrically how Martha Graham launched her revolution, so they can experience really how dramatic the shift was in American dance at that era. So we begin with some of the dances, the style of dancing that Martha Graham would have studied and performed and emerged out of, but then rejected. And you see some of that dance, and then you see some of Martha Graham's very early revolutionary works. And it's a real reminder of how she launched this incredible shift.
What I'm especially excited about is the Lamentation Variations, which is a connection of course, one of her iconic works, but seen in a new way. Three contemporary choreographers contributing there.
Right, and it also theatrically demonstrates to our audiences just the enormous influence and resonance Graham's discoveries have been over the years. This is very contemporary choreography and very different styles. We asked three young choreographers to view a DVD of Martha Graham dancing her iconic solo Lamentation and to create choreographic sketches in reaction to that solo, each with their own very distinct style. There are creative rules for these short works. We give each choreographer 10 hours of rehearsal only. Mm. We tell them they have to keep it under 4 minutes long, which is how long Lamentation is. They can choose any number of dancers in the company. They have to choose public domain music and simple costumes, et cetera. And in fact, it's been so successful that we have commissioned two more Lamentation Variations. There are a total of five now. And we've just commissioned three more new ones that will premiere next March. So it's an ongoing project allows us to have a wide range of artistic voices working for us and for our company to be performing very diverse work, but all organically tied to who we are.
Have you had any conversations with the choreographers after it was done, after the rehearsal, and whether they were intimidated? Because this is one of the most iconic dances that you can think of in American history. Were they excited? Were they scared? All of the above?
they all complain about the rules. You know, they think 10 hours of rehearsal is way too little. And each one of them has broken one of the rules somehow, you know, using extra time or using fancier costumes or not using public domain music. But in fact, they find the rules kind of liberating because we don't try to limit their style. We don't ask them to be Martha Graham. We ask them to intensely be themselves and just to use this work to spark their own creativity. And they're highly appreciative of it.
You know, for decades, dancers in this company knew and were influenced personally by Martha Graham. You would have a connection because the person was there. Now, there are many dancers, of course, who don't have that ability, never met her. Do you think that makes any difference whatsoever?
Yes, I think it probably frees the work in a way, kind of maybe relates to this idea that America now has some perspective on its own history in the 20th century. Graham dancers and the dance world in general has a more of a context to view Martha, a perspective on her work. I mean, you know, we could compare it to actors who perform Shakespeare.
Right.
they've got what he's left behind. They've got the roadmap. They've got the blueprint. And their own interpretation is what's essential to keeping the art relevant and alive today. And that is, in fact, what Martha taught us. I worked closely with Martha, and she wanted you to invest yourself. She didn't want you to mimic her performance or performances of other dancers who may have performed the roles before you. She expected you to fully invest yourself, the uniqueness of yourself in each role. So that's the line of thought that we take from Martha and are inspired by to
continue in her work.
The performance at Walton Arts Center is Thursday night, October 6th at 7. Thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. We can't wait to be down there.
Janet Eilber is the artistic director of the Martha Graham Dance Company. The 2011-2012 Martha Dance Company Tour includes a stop at Walton Arts Center Thursday night, October 6th. For more information, waltonartscenter.org. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
We're inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio, and three musicians are with us. I'm going to ask the three of you to introduce yourselves, if you would, please.
I'm Matt Cartier.
Pete Howard.
And Gretchen Schlump.
And collectively?
Fork and Knife.
The music that you guys play as Fork and Knife is older than you are. Considerably.
Yes.
Pete, you and I have talked about this before on other occasions. What is the attraction to the music that makes you like love it so much, research it so much, and play it so often?
Well, the energy of it and the fact that it's homemade, you know. And it's native to the area is the other thing that we're attracted to it.
Yeah, native to this region is real big drive for us. It's kind of the pre-radio music from this region, you know, so it kind of informs it. It's a bit of the culture from this region, you know, stretching back to kind of the beginnings of people being here. So, or not people, but the settlers that came across. So we really enjoy that connection to the local area and the land that it comes from. So
definitely is a homegrown entertainment, and you can really feel that when you're playing the music and having a square dance, and it's just the musicians and the caller and the dancers, and there's no paid entertainment. It's just everybody in a community entertaining themselves. It's really a great joy.
You know, that let's entertain ourselves, let's put on a show, and everyone is at least some part, especially a square dance. It's everyone participating, or everyone's invited anyway.
Right, musicians and dancers, right.
Because square dance is a traditional music form, and it's been around for a long time, and you do see it from time to time celebrated here. I know that Prairie Grove takes great pride during the Labor Day.
The Clothesline Fair.
The Clothesline Fair, exactly. Thank you, Christina. And so there are obviously roots all throughout the South, but in the Ozarks too. But how many people, you know, under 80 have square dance? Not a lot. So help us, walk us through what a good square dance involves.
Well, it's a good band and a good caller. The band is playing, you know, usually traditional tunes and has a good drive to it. It's real. The fiddle is fairly essential.
Totally essential.
And just kind of what they put into the music, the sprightliness that they put into the music is kind of the real driving behind the music. The guitar generally is more of the like bass instrument. You have a caller, and the caller basically is there to, one, teach you how to do the dance if you don't know how to do it, and then kind of throughout the whole dance they basically call and tell you what to do, but as well as just telling you what to do, they have little rhymes that goes along with everything that kind of keeps time with the music and injects its own energy into the dance. So and then the dancers, you know, the combination of those instruments, the dancers definitely feel that, and that kind of really pushes the squares around the floor. So
the fiddle tunes are regional that we play, but Matt has done a lot of research into calls, square dance calls that come from the Ozarks, and there's a lot that have been collected. Vance Randolph collected some, and some are, you know, standard, and some of them kind of verge on the risque as well.
A little bit body?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Matt throws in him every once in a while.
Only late
night.
Yeah, late night.
Those are usually house dances.
Yeah. Yeah.
So help, the caller is very important, and it sounds like it could be something of a stressful
Yeah, the
I
callers,
mean, the responsibility is laying there, right?
Yeah,
there.
Definitely. I mean, you're definitely the interaction. You're definitely the one responsible for all the dancers to have fun, you know, and that's the essential thing about square dancing. It's really all about having fun, you know. It's if you screw up a square dance, it's really just as much fun as dancing it right, usually, you know. So so there is a lot of you kind of have to be a real good teacher real quick and a real good caller and know the music well and know the dances real well and to be able to kind of judge the dancers and kind of figure out where they're at and get them to kind of be in a fun place. So
we've been talking a lot about square dance. Can we hear some music?
Let's do
Sounds
it.
Great.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We're going to play a tune that comes from a fellow named Bill Blue, who was from Southwest Missouri, and he was the uncle of Mark Blue, who's a singer-songwriter and also played with Big Smith for years. And this guy was recorded, Bill Blue was recorded by Library of Congress back in the late 40s. And so we learned this off of the Library of Congress recording. It's called Rabbit in the Briar Patch. And I haven't heard it anywhere else.
Okay. Fantastic. What's great about this music is that it doesn't have to be exactly like you ever heard it, because that's part of the tradition, right? Mm-hmm. Putting your own spin on it. And
a little bit. We've been trying to get pretty close to the sound that we heard. The banjo is kind of an added thing here on this. They didn't have banjo on that original recording, but had guitar and fiddle, and the guitar player was a lot more wild and rambunctious than Gretchen. He was a lot of fun to listen to, but he probably would have thrown the dancers off the dance floor with his speed, I think.
So this particular, you mentioned that Library of Congress recorded it. I guess you don't have any music to read. You just have, this is by ear?
Yep. Sure is. Learned by ear.
Most of the music, I mean, almost all the music that we learn is by ear. We don't, I guess I don't even read music. I'm sure Pete does, but but most of the time we just actually listen to the recordings and learn that way. So it is still an oral tradition. Yeah. So the music doesn't quite, the printed music doesn't quite give the lilt and the drive that the fiddle tunes actually contain. If you don't listen to them, they sound real flat and mundane, kind of. But it's the actual players who kind of put the real drive behind it that makes it amazing.
Can we hear something else?
Sure. What else we got, Matt? This is a tune from a fellow who lived up in southern Missouri. His name was Uncle Bunk Williams. And he was recorded back in the 70s. He was real old, and he played kind of scratchy. But this one really stuck out real clean. It's called Old Pete, no relation to me. And it has one of those ancient sounding mountain melodies to it. We like it a lot. The banjo fits in there real well.
Cartier, Pete Howard, and Gretchen Schlump are Fork and Knife. They'll play for a square dance tonight at Scarpino on West Avenue in Fayetteville. Doors open at 7:30, and the dancing lasts from 8 until 11. They're scheduled to play a square dance once a month at Scarpino.
And Fork and Knife will also play tomorrow night at Greenhouse Grill in Fayetteville. And on Sunday's edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large, we'll hear one more song they recorded inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. That's Sunday morning at 9 on KUAF.
KUAF is supported by Pays Interactive, a Northwest Arkansas-based company offering custom app design and programming for businesses and ideas of all sizes. Apps Farkle, WordShout, My Lists, and more available on the iTunes App Store under PAZE. PaysInteractive.com for more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Hiawassee. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Christina, thanks for co-hosting for the first time.
Thank you for having me.
Did you like it?
I did. It was enjoyable.
Will you come back?
For sure, if you'll have me.
I will. Thanks.